The year is 1776. A young nation struggles to be born. It's October, and as the year draws to an end, it would surprise most people in the 13 colonies to learn that future generations would see 1776 as the year America became independent. At this point, it looks like the rebellion will be crushed. The Declaration of Independence was signed 3 months ago in Philadelphia, but with most of the East Coast still under British control, its goals are very aspirational. The largest battle of the war just ended, with New York City decisively returning to British hands. Skirmishes go on in New Jersey, but Washington's armies are clearly on the back foot. The Continental Congress worries Philadelphia will be the next to fall. They contemplate fleeing south. New England is still reliably under rebel control for now, but they've got other problems. An epidemic is sweeping the states. Of what? It's not clear. At the time, they called it Columbus Fever, after the name of a Continental Navy ship, alleged to have started the outbreak after it docked in Providence and released dying British prisoners of war. Most modern historians say it was typhus, which spreads fast in dirty, confined quarters and is easy to misdiagnose as all of a dozen different things, but others dispute this, saying the type of louse that spreads typhus hadn't reached North America yet. Either way, the fog of war stirs up disease. It's a universal rule across human history that in every war, more people die of sickness than on the battlefield. In Cumberland, Rhode Island, the fever has reached the Wilkinson household. The Wilkinsons are Quakers and members of an academic elite among that sect. Their cousin, Stephen Hopkins, is the governor of Rhode Island and a signatory of the Declaration of Independence. General Benedict Arnold, the infamous traitor to the American Revolution, is a distant relative too. At this point, he's yet to defect to the British. 23-year-old Jemima Wilkinson, unmarried and still living with her parents as the 8th of 12 children, has been stricken with Columbus fever. Her condition worsens. She becomes delirious, and her father summons a doctor from a neighboring town. Even wealthy people regularly lost their children to disease in those days. That's why you have 12 children. Within a few days, it's assumed Jemima is a lost cause. And then the fever breaks. Surrounded by her family, Jemima sits up in bed. Everyone is overjoyed that Jemima has survived until she announces to her gathered relatives that she didn't survive. Jemima Wilkinson is dead. She was taken by the fever and is now in heaven. In her place, God has filled her former body with an ageless, genderless spirit known as the Public Universal Friend. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and Sluds the Shoggoth. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosity. To talk about the friend, one must first talk about the friends. The religious society of friends, that is, who, like many other religious sects, are most commonly referred to by a name originally created to mock them, the Quakers. Picture a Quaker in your mind. What are you picturing? Is it this guy? It's this guy, right? The Quaker Oatmeal Man is based on the appearance of William Penn, a leader of the Quakers' migration from England to America in the 17th century, and the brand is called that because Quakers are associated with cleanliness, honesty, and a sort of homely fantasy of colonial America. The Quaker Oats Company has no official ties to the Religious Society of Friends, and using the brand and imagery of an existing Christian sect has sometimes annoyed real-life Quakers. You wouldn't name a serial Mormon and use a caricature of Brigham Young as your logo, would you? Well, why wouldn't you? Ask most Americans this, and I think they'd respond, because the Mormons, unlike the Quakers, still exist. But the Quakers still exist too, something that it took me a while to realize a lot of people don't know. You may have heard that the Quakers have only two living members left. First of all, no. You're thinking of the Shakers. Easy to confuse the two. The Shakers were a very ideologically similar sect in colonial America, mostly led by women. And second of all, while until recently the Shakers did have just two members left, living at a compound called Sabbath Day Lake in Maine, last year they gained a new convert. There's a third Shaker, making them now one of the fastest growing religions in America. But the Quakers number about 100,000 in the U.S. today, and have produced some notable figures into the present day. Randall Monroe, the creator of XKCD, was raised as a Quaker, which somehow makes sense to me. Two presidents were Quakers, and this you don't hear often, because this doesn't make sense. They were Herbert Hoover and Richard Nixon. I never said the Quakers always practice what they preach. I grew up literally next door to a Quaker meeting house. In fact, when I'm home in the room I grew up in and I try to text someone my location, often my phone will pick up my location as Eugene Friends Meeting. And I have relatives in New England who are still practicing Quakers. I had to sit through incredibly long Quaker weddings as a kid. And in the 1990s, when the Quaker Oats Company, which owns Cap'n Crunch, among other classic cereal brands, began including Power Rangers toys in Cap'n Crunch boxes, real Quakers started an angry letter-writing campaign. Power Rangers, you see, promotes violence. If you know one other thing about Quakers, it's probably that, their doctrine of nonviolence. Because their sect is staunchly anti-war, Quakers are the original conscientious objectors. They're the sect that the legal concept of a conscientious objector was invented for. People had demanded, and sometimes been granted, exemption from a military draft because of their religion for thousands of years, but the first law allowing a whole specific sect to not be conscripted was passed in Britain in 1757 to protect Quakers. How to deal with the Quakers was a long-standing question in both Britain and America through the 17th and 18th centuries, because Quakers objected to a lot of other aspects of society too. Originally founded in the mid-1600s in England by a preacher named George Fox, the Society of Friends was one of the first large-scale groups to oppose slavery. They refused to recite oaths of allegiance to the crown, or any crown, or anyone, which made them easy to identify. Some were vegetarians, and numbered among the earliest animal rights activists in the Western world. They let women preach, which was unheard of then and still unheard of today in most Christian denominations. In fact, they let anyone preach, because Quakers object to the idea that some people are closer to God than others, and prefer the doctrine of a priesthood of all believers. They initially never used the pronoun you, instead calling everyone thee and thou, because calling someone you originally implied distance and formality, while thee and thou were how you address a friend. And to the Society of Friends, everyone was a friend. But not everyone wanted to be their friend, and in the 1670s, the Quakers began trying to get out of England. William Penn, a British nobleman who had converted to Quakerism despite their increasing oppression, petitioned King Charles II to grant him a colony that the Quakers could flee to. To his surprise, the gambit worked, with the king designating a huge territory in America for the Quakers. Penn, with a Quaker's modesty, didn't want to name it after himself. He wanted to call it Sylvania, Latin for forest. The king overruled his wishes and named it Pennsylvania. Quaker Pennsylvania was one of the first territories in the world to guarantee freedom of religion and the right to a fair trial by a jury of your peers. 100 years later, by the time the 13 colonies were fighting for their independence, Quakers were still one of the dominant religious and political forces in America. There aren't that many Quakers left anymore, but I'd stop short of saying they're no longer relevant. For a long time, the Quaker population of North America was only declining in relative terms, not absolute terms. Because of the Quakers' tolerance, Pennsylvania's population boomed, to the point that, before long, Quakers themselves were a minority. They sort of tolerated themselves into oblivion. But their influence lingered. The frame of government of Pennsylvania that William Penn had written became the main influence on the U.S. Constitution. To this day, although they may be too modest to say it, I think Quakers have a better claim to being the people who founded America than any other single group. So many distinctive things about American culture can be attributed to the influence of the Quakers. Quakers were, and are, devoutly religious, but also devoted to progressive and egalitarian activism, feminist but strongly sex negative, deeply individualist in their conception of God, and at home in the capitalist world. Several big banks that survive to this day were founded by Quakers, and before they moved to America, Quakers occupied a social status in England kind of like Jews, in that they were officially oppressed, but often powerful in the finance world. Quakers are fundamental in the history of both the abolition of slavery and the rise of multinational corporations. American values are Quaker values. By and large, this is a Quaker nation. The Wilkinson family of Rhode Island had ancestors from another interesting sect, the Camisards of southern France. They too were a Christian sect that opposed having a rigidly codified priesthood and promoted an individualist personal relationship with God. Quite what they believe beyond that is unclear, because most historical sources on the Camisards come from the French Catholics who fought them and tried to depict them as heretical as possible. They might not even have been an organized religious group at all, just a slur the Catholics used for all kinds of non-conforming Christians in the hills of southern France, but some sources tantalizingly suggest that a key Camisard belief was that male biblical figures would come back and preach again as women. The Camisards were driven out of France after the Edict of Fontainebleau re-established Catholicism as France's only permitted religion. Some fled to England, then America, and became Quakers. Whether a young Jemima Wilkinson ever knew this about her family's background can't be known. But now, the person in Jemima's bed, wearing Jemima's nightie, was insisting that Jemima was dead. And the person now speaking was not really a person at all, but the public universal friend. The phrase sounds oddly modern to encounter coming out of people's mouths in 1776, but the Wilkinsons would be familiar with the concept of a public friend, an itinerant Quaker preacher who goes from town to town. The Quakers may have been opposed to having an ordained priesthood, but there have always been Quaker preachers, of course, because some people like preaching more than others. Many public friends in Revolutionary War-era America were women, and even the concept of a Quaker woman having a religious awakening after recovering from a fever and spending the rest of her life traveling and preaching was a well-established phenomenon around the time. But there is almost no precedent in Quaker history or beyond to something like this. The story of the public universal friend combines several rare and intriguing phenomena: a sudden lasting personality change after a near-death experience, a religious leader claiming to be some sort of non-human spiritual entity, and of course, the part that makes the friend most fascinating to today's audience is gender nonconformity in early modern times. But the northeastern U.S. was already a cauldron of religious ferment around then, because of the doctrine of religious tolerance, because immigrants turned to religion to find something to tie them to their unfamiliar new home, because literacy was now widespread for the first time in human history, and with it ordinary people were developing their own interpretations of the Bible, and just because strange ideas spread when times are tough, wandering revivalist preachers and would-be cults were a dime a dozen in Revolutionary War-era New England. Christian-adjacent revival movements in the 18th century get classified as part of the First Great Awakening, which led somewhat seamlessly into the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century, which centered on the so-called burned-over district of upstate New York. I touched on the Second Great Awakening and the burned-over district in my episode about another all-American pseudo-Christian revivalist, Cyrus Teed. Even before she was reborn as the public universal friend, Jemima Wilkinson was on shaky terms with the Quakers because she'd attended meetings of another sect, the New Light Baptists, a long-forgotten product of the First Great Awakening, who seemed to be really into personal divine visitations. When the friend attended Jemima's regular Quaker meeting group, they ridiculed the idea that Jemima had been replaced with a genderless spiritual warrior. So the friend left the Society of Friends and began preaching by friend self. We must now familiarize ourselves with the friend's pronouns. It's tempting to they-them the friend, and many sources today do exactly that. The use of singular they to refer to a general category of people, or a person whose gender isn't clear, dates back to the 14th century in uses like, say, "I'll ask the waiter when they get to our table." And if you look up who the first individual person to go by they-them pronouns was, a lot of sources will tell you it was the public universal friend. It's conceivable that some people writing about the friend at the time referred to the friend as they, in the sense that I just used it now. It's an intuitive way to refer to someone of an indeterminate gender, but the friend never recommended a particular pronoun. Most contemporary reporting on the friend refers to the friend as Jemima Wilkinson, a woman. Fascinatingly, the friend's followers, the people who really bought into the friend's gender identity, mostly referred to the friend as a he. But this too was rejected by the friend. Today, a shaky consensus holds that the friend didn't want to use any pronouns and should be referred to simply as the friend in all contexts. The only widely recorded clarification the friend ever gave on the friend's gender identity was when the friend was asked point blank, "Are you a man or a woman?" to which the friend responded by quoting God's proclamation to Moses in the book of Exodus, "I am that I am." Understandably, the friend stirred up a fair amount of controversy, both inside and outside the Quaker world, when the friend began preaching. Those who came to attend the friend's sermons were mostly drawn by the friend's uniqueness as a character, and less by the religious content of the speeches, which was apparently stirring but nothing for the ages. Most accounts of what the friend preached suggest it was pretty similar to standard Quaker doctrine. Equality, nonviolence, personal relationship with God. Also, sex is really, really bad. Don't do it. One Abner Brownell, an early follower of the friend who later left the movement, wrote that the friend's sermons, quote, "damned whores, witches, Jezebels, and fornicators," which doesn't sound very progressive today, but was part and parcel of the egalitarian Christian revivalism that Quakerism was just one version of. Quaker women were so prudish about sex, they referred to anything from their neck to their waist as their stomach, and anything below that as their ankles. And this, too, was relatively new. Just a few centuries before the rise of Quakerism, most families all slept in the same bed. Privacy in pre-modern times barely existed as a cultural concept, because how could it? Around the same time Quakerism was gaining converts in England, a popular saying went, "Do nothing privately, which you would not do publicly." Letters and diaries recount growing up with your parents having sex right next to you, treating that as a casual universal annoyance like traffic and taxes. Purity culture can only go so far in that world. We think of people in early modern times as massive prudes, but premarital sex was very common in colonial America. Sex work was legal and widespread, culturally frowned on for both sexes, but in the same way as, like, drinking too much. All men have done it once. In 1790, an estimated 30% of American brides were pregnant on their wedding day. Medieval English towns often had streets called Great Lane, which were red light districts frequented by traveling merchants. Most such streets still exist, but have been cleaned up and renamed things like Grape Lane. Sexual prudishness peaked in the Victorian era and had been a lot less of a big deal before then. Today, Quakerism is more communitarian than the broader culture, but back then Quakers stood out for being individualistic. That meant supporting individual privacy, and that meant frowning on public displays of affection and any connection between the sexual world and the public world. The friend's sex negativity went hand in hand with feminism, abolitionism, and nonviolence as new controversial currents of thought. There are parallels, once again, to Cyrus Teed. I can't link the same video twice, but Teed, about 100 years later, was another weird Christian preacher whose theology was feminist, pacifist, and strongly sex negative. The friend's sermons were sometimes met by mobs wielding, quote, "stones and brickbats," as one letter from the time described, but these seemed to be mostly just anti-Quaker rioters. Overall, although few people saw the public universal friend as worth listening to and taking seriously, the friend's gender fuckery was mostly treated with amused curiosity. The idea of someone being what we'd now call non-binary was simply too foreign to hate. The friend's followers were outnumbered at the sermons by people who were just intrigued. Leading lights of the time wrote about the friend in a detached, almost ethnographic sense, noting the friend's combination of masculine and feminine features. Abner Brownell wrote that the friend's voice was, quote, "very grum and shrill for a woman." Grum is a fantastic 18th century word that should really come back. It was never considered standard English because it probably originated as a combination of the words grim and glum, but I'm gonna start calling things grum in my episodes, and I'm gonna see if it catches on. Unlike grim and glum, grum was usually used to describe a tone of voice, one that was deep and sonorous and possibly monstrous. In stories, demons and ghosts were often said to have grum voices. Opportunistic preachers of the time would sometimes use ventriloquists' dummies as a sort of seance-like performance, commanding a good or evil spirit to inhabit the dummy, at which point the dummy would begin speaking in, yep, voices that were grum and shrill. Shrill meant roughly the same thing then that it does now, but it wasn't an antonym of grum. A voice that was grum and shrill was deep, loud, and echoing, piercing without being high-pitched. If there was a band called Grum and Shrill, what kind of music would they play? I'm thinking it would either be a college a cappella group, or folk metal, or a Swedish 90s ambient electronic duo. Ezra Stiles, president of Yale University, recounted seeing the friend give sermons in New Haven, Connecticut, writing in his diary that the friend dressed with a man's cape, a purple gown, long sleeves, a man's shirt down to the hands, and a purple handkerchief or neckcloth, which Quaker men wore, but not the women. The friend wore a man's hat and took it off indoors. Women were supposed to leave their hats on inside. Another contemporary, Jacob Hiltzheimer of Philadelphia, stated that she looks more like a man than a woman. David Hudson, a lawyer who wrote the first biography of the friend in 1821, stated that the friend dressed in a fashion entirely her own, which neither resembled neither that of men or women. Hudson, along with other writers of the time, speculated on what kind of undergarments the friend wore underneath the robes due to her external appearance of being neither man nor woman. But the big question about the friend at the time had nothing to do with gender. What, theologically speaking, was the friend? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that what the friend is saying is true, said thinkers of the time. The friend had asserted that Jemima Wilkinson died, and some divine spirit beyond human categories like gender and ethnicity had possessed her body. That can happen? People of varying creeds across the 13 colonies asked, and it was a genuine question. Can that happen in Quaker theology? If the public universal friend really is telling the truth, does that mean the friend is an angel? Does that mean the friend is the second coming of Christ? Debate raged, and to this day you'll see some sources say that the friend directly claimed to be the second coming of Christ. When the friend came to preach in Philadelphia in 1782, the city's main newspaper printed multiple accounts of the friend's sermons claiming that the friend was calling friend self the second coming. Abner Brownell records an intriguing claim that the friend would regularly quote Jeremiah 31:22, which says, "A woman shall compass a man," compass here meaning embrace, encircle, or comfort, to mean that the first coming of Jesus was as a man, but the second coming will be a woman. The friend very well may have said this, but if so, it probably means something more interesting than the friend claiming to be Jesus. Because again, the friend didn't want to be known as a woman. So if the friend had said it was prophesied in the Bible that the second coming would be a woman, that didn't mean the friend was saying, "I am Jesus." That meant the friend was saying the second coming hadn't happened yet. It would be someone else, and that person would be a woman. That could suggest that, despite preaching that Jemima Wilkinson was dead and in heaven, the friend may have held on to the French Camisard beliefs passed down through the Wilkinson family, and therefore that other similar beliefs might have survived, practiced quietly within families long after historians thought they were extinct. It's also well established that the friend said there was no gender in heaven. The friend would also refer to friend self as the comforter sometimes, and said the friend was sent by Jesus Christ, implying that the friend was not literally Jesus Christ. One commonly reported story while the friend was alive holds that the friend claimed to be able to walk on water, ending sermons by proclaiming, "Do ye believe that I can do this? Do ye have faith?" "We believe," chorused the assembled crowd. "If ye have faith, ye need no other evidence," said the friend, and left. Non-binary Quaker messiahs will be like, "You believe in praying? That pales in effectiveness to my strategy, walking on water," and then not walk on water. But anyway, this was probably invented to demonize the friend. There are even accounts of curious people who attended sermons by the public universal friend in order to see this back and forth in person and were disappointed that it didn't happen. One disgruntled attendee in Philadelphia said, "From common report, I expected to hear something out of the way in doctrine, which is not the case. In fact, I heard nothing but what is common among preachers." Some of the friend's followers believed that regardless of what the friend directly said, the friend was the second coming of Christ. But that was a heavy allegation, and other friends of the friend vigorously denied that the friend wanted anyone to believe that. It's one thing to be a Christian and follow a spiritual leader. It's quite another to be a Christian and follow a spiritual leader who claims to be the Messiah. You better be damn sure you're following the right Messiah, pun intended, because if not, that's blasphemy, or else everyone else poo-pooing them is going to hell. The public acceptance of the public universal friend hinged on whether the friend claimed to be the second coming or not. If the friend didn't, the friend was an oddity. If the friend did, the friend was a heresy. And we don't fully know. So few of the friend's sermons survive, and they're drenched in so many layers of discourse and interpretation from the partisans of each side, it's not certain what the friend ever claimed. Historical consensus leans closer to no, but it's a lean. Many people claim to have directly asked the friend, "Are you the second coming of Christ?" and received a simple yes or no. May 19th, 1780, dawned like any other day in New England, but quickly it became clear that something very strange was happening. Birds stopped singing. Nocturnal animals came out. The sky began to darken. By noon, it was dark as night across the entire northeastern U.S. A foul smell hung in the air. Where the sun could be seen, it was blood red and gave off such little light, people could stare right at it and see sunspots. To a country already at war, already brimming with religious fervor, this was the final straw. Thousands of people deserted their jobs, their homes, their families, certain that the end of days was upon them. Cults, of which there were many, prepared to be raptured. In the Connecticut State Legislature, a politician named Abraham Davenport rebuked his co-workers, who were confident the apocalypse had arrived, saying, "The day of judgment is either approaching or it is not. If it is not, there is no cause for an adjournment. If it is, I choose to be found doing my duty. I wish, therefore, that candles may be brought." You may have guessed what was actually going on. Far up in Ontario, far beyond where Europeans had explored much at that point, a massive natural forest fire was raging. For just one day, the air currents carried a thick band of smoke over New England. But this was only conclusively proven relatively recently, and the Dark Day, as it came to be known, was one of the greatest American historical mysteries for over a century. 2 years before the Dark Day, the public universal friend and five followers attempted to sail to England and preach against the ongoing war at its source. This gambit failed when the British authorities denied the friend passage, but this brought the friend to the attention of William Potter, a justice of the Rhode Island Supreme Court, who became the friend's most prominent supporter and main financial benefactor. Potter was so taken by the friend's preaching that he was convinced to free his slaves, who became converts to the friend's movement as well. By the time the Dark Day descended in 1780, the friend lived in Potter's mansion and ran several churches across Rhode Island and Connecticut. Where the liturgy didn't differ much from standard Quaker doctrine other than the belief in the holiness of the public universal friend, the friends of the friend were a broad swath of colonial American life, a fairly representative sample of the overall population in terms of age, race, gender, and social status. You may expect that the friend's following was especially dominated by women, and those closest to the friend were always women, but the overall gender balance seemed to be about 50-50. Even before the Dark Day, the friend's followers had been expecting something big to happen. While it's not clear if the friend ever directly said this, many believers cited Revelation 11:2, "And the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months, to mean that the end of the world, or the second coming of Christ, or something, would happen 42 months after the public universal friend was incarnated in the body of the former Jemima Wilkinson. That would put the apocalypse in April 1780, right before the Dark Day. The friend took the Dark Day as validation of the prediction and began using it to recruit new followers. The friend and a handful of disciples traveled to Philadelphia, still the main center of Quakerism, and preached. Later, the friend temporarily established a headquarters in Worcester, Pennsylvania. All this preaching only served to publicize the friend further, which, unfortunately, worked against the goal of gaining more followers. Now the public universal friend was well known, and so being a follower of the friend distinctly marked you as a weirdo in a way it hadn't before. Some early followers deserted the friend, and few new ones joined, even as the friend preached across Pennsylvania and New England nearly every day for years. And then, in 1787, disaster struck. At a house in Pennsylvania, inhabited by several young disciples of the public universal friend, a bizarre midnight scuffle over a chamber pot, the exact details of which were never clear, ended with an attempted murder charge against one Abigail Dayton. Another friend of the friend, Sarah Wilson, asserted that Dayton tried to strangle her in her sleep after they went to bed following an argument. The press went wild, and soon the story morphed into the claim that the public universal friend, who was actually back home in Rhode Island at the time, had tried to kill a young woman all by friend self, or at least that there was some kind of religious motive for the crime, that Dayton was trying to make Wilson into a staged martyr to gain more followers, or Dayton believed Wilson wasn't sufficiently devoted to the friend, while all reasonable examination of the scuffle suggests that the crime was over an argument completely unrelated to religion. If Dayton really had tried to strangle Wilson, which was never clear and may actually have been a dream or sleep paralysis on Wilson's part. Either way, this was the public universal friend's Zizian's moment. Now everyone knew, or thought they knew, about the followers of the public universal friend and believed them to be stone cold killers. Other rumors surfaced that the friend traveled with a team of 12 followers called the Apostles, which would be blasphemous. And even that the male followers of the friend were forced to castrate themselves, which is actually a thing some esoteric Christian sects have done, but definitely not this one. The friend had to take the flock somewhere far from the world's prying eyes, upstate New York. The area was still largely unsettled by Europeans at the time and corrupt land speculation of the sort that I talked about in my episode about the early settling of Wisconsin was rife. The land originally belonged to the Haudenosaunee, the native tribe usually known in historical sources as the Iroquois. The French up in Quebec gave them that name, but Iroquois is neither a French nor Haudenosaunee word, nor does it have any resemblance to words in neighboring tribes' languages, so that's a bit of a mystery, but that's beside the point. The Haudenosaunee were still there, and hundreds of thousands of settlers were trying to get their land, both by the sword and by the pen. One group of land speculators attempted to get them to sign a 999-year lease of their land, which was only stopped when the state government stepped in. The public universal friend was sympathetic to the plight of the Haudenosaunee, and even wore a combination of European and Haudenosaunee clothes, sometimes while preaching, because a key part of the friend's theology was that the public universal friend transcends both gender and ethnicity. This will become important later. But the friends of the friend did want to start a community of their own, up in Haudenosaunee territory, like a Sarah Lawrence grad who moves to the Bronx to become a tenant organizer and starts complaining about gentrification. They founded a settlement on Seneca Lake in central New York, near today's town of Penyan, where the ownership of the land changed several times as speculators, the state government, and the Haudenosaunee surveyed and resurveyed their claims. The Friends settlement happened to lie right on the preemption line, a border running north-south through upstate New York that had been decided on by an interstate treaty between New York and Massachusetts. Those kinds of things happened a lot in those days because the states were almost thought of as independent countries. East of the preemption line, the state of Massachusetts had the right to carve up the land and sell it to settlers and speculators, even though that territory was still in New York. West of the preemption line was Haudenosaunee territory, belonging to the state of New York, where both the state and the tribe had control over land purchases. The exact location of the preemption line changed with repeated surveys, sometimes leaving the Friends settlement east of it, sometimes west. They had to appeal directly to New York Governor George Clinton, different guy, who surprisingly granted them a 14,000-acre territory. The friend named this community New Jerusalem, which some viewers may remember was also the name of Cyrus Teed's utopian commune. This is because in the Book of Revelation, New Jerusalem is the name given to God's kingdom on earth that descends after the Judgment Day, so it's a pretty obvious thing to call a utopian Christian commune. The canonical biblical description of New Jerusalem is, to use a delicate and carefully thought-out term to avoid offending anyone, batshit bonkers. A whole chapter of the Book of Revelation, in fact the second to last chapter in the entire Bible, is devoted to describing it in detail. The New Jerusalem is a 1,500-mile gold-tinted glass cube that descends from heaven onto earth. The throne of God is at the center, which provides light through the entire cube in which all of humanity will live. There are towers, palaces, and natural environments with trees and rivers inside this vast, ringworld-esque arcology. That's in the Bible! That's awesome! Why does Scientology have any appeal when this is part of the scriptures of the world's biggest and most powerful religion? The public Universal Friends New Jerusalem was less luxurious. It had a population of about 300 people at its peak, which at the time made it the largest non-indigenous settlement in western New York. In retellings of the public Universal Friends life, you sometimes hear the claim that around 1790, one in five white settlers in New York State west of Syracuse was a follower of the public Universal Friend. This may have been accurate, but should be taken less as the friend had a massive following, which was never true, and more as the sample size was really, really small. The friend tried to pursue cordial relations with the Haudenosaunee, which made the other settlers in the area even more leery. Once again, the friend had always been friendly to indigenous people, having befriended Samson Occam, a Presbyterian minister of Mohegan descent, at a funeral in Connecticut in 1786. In 1794, after having moved to New Jerusalem, the friend was invited by Colonel Timothy Pickering, who George Washington would name as his third Secretary of State the next year, to participate in negotiations with the Haudenosaunee in a town near New Jerusalem. There, according to a mainstream Quaker preacher who was also there, the friend, quote, "had yesterday told the Indians to repent, and they now called the white people to repent." I found this quote in a book and can't find the original full source the quote is excerpted from, but this may be an example of someone they-theming the public universal friend. I can't be sure without context. Either way, the friend preached equally to the Haudenosaunee and to the whites gathered there, which Pickering found presumptuous, but the Haudenosaunee apparently appreciated. Another witness said the friend gave a speech, quote, "with an intention of supporting the importance of peace and love among the Indians and all men." In response, the Haudenosaunee sachems at the conference gave the friend the Haudenosaunee name of Shinawauna Gistauga, meaning a great woman preacher. Perhaps nobody ever told them that the friend was supposed to be genderless. Perhaps they were told that and just didn't understand. The Haudenosaunee have sometimes been described as a matriarchal society, and they partially were. They were led by a legislature of 56 male chiefs called sachems, but motherhood was what carried real political power. Each sachem was appointed by a vote of their local clan's mothers, who could also recall a sachem from office if he voted against the mother's interest. A well-spoken woman preacher negotiating a treaty would not have been unusual to the Haudenosaunee. Life in the Friends' New Jerusalem wasn't too crazy. While often described as a commune, it was not communist, the way many later Christian revival movements encouraged collective ownership. Instead, everyone owned their private property, in keeping with the Quaker spirit of individual enterprise. Celibacy was encouraged, and having children was discouraged, but it wasn't totally illegal, and many weddings and pregnancies did end up happening without any repercussions. That was more tolerant than the celibacy laws in the Shaker communities, and there were lots of those around New England at the time. Except for one big thing that we still remember the friend for today, not a lot about New Jerusalem was shockingly weird to really anyone. In fact, one thing that consistently surprises me about the public universal friend is how, in every way but the gender fluidity, the friend's gospel and following were remarkably normal for the time and place. Plenty of outsiders had that revelation too at the time. Wait, for all the rumors, these people are just ordinary Quakers. Well, okay, there was one pretty distinctive feature of New Jerusalem. Apparently, the friend ate meals away from the rest of the flock, and everyone else was only allowed to start eating once the friend was finished, except for one woman, one Rachel Mallon, the only person permitted to eat with the friend and live in the friend's house. Mallon was also the only follower who would always consistently travel with the friend, who recorded the friend's prophetic dreams, and when the friend drew up a will, almost everything the friend owned was to be left to Rachel Mallon. Mallon was herself married to a man named Enoch, another friend of the friend, but Enoch Mallon apparently had several affairs with other women in New Jerusalem and, despite their general rules against this, didn't ever seem to be seriously punished for it. The friend was also surrounded by an inner circle of up to 20 women who had renounced marriage and motherhood and referred to themselves as the Sisterhood. The friend gradually appeared in public less and less, and the women of the Sisterhood were seen as the friend's mouthpiece. Make of all this what you will. New Jerusalem wasn't isolated for long. The Haudenosaunee Treaty territory was shrinking, and settlers, mostly from New England, were pouring into western New York. Many had heard wild rumors about the public universal friend and were astounded to find that the friend still had a following out in what was then the wilderness. more rumors began to spread that the friend was romantically involved with, quote, another masculine woman, possibly Rachel Mallon, we don't know, and more alarmingly, that James Parker, one of the friend's leading male followers, had discovered, quote, a young girl of only 14 in the friend's bed, which was the beginning of Parker's crusade against the person he'd once seen as a savior. More people began leaving New Jerusalem at this point, less because of that incident in particular, which may never have really happened, and more because the friend ultimately wasn't that inspiring. There was nothing you could get from her sermons that you couldn't get from any other decent Quaker preacher, and if you attend church with any other preacher, you won't be tarred as a weirdo cultist. Many had come to see the friend as surprisingly selfish and greedy, and therefore worthless as a spiritual leader. A French nobleman who'd fled to America after his country had a revolution stopped in New Jerusalem out of curiosity in 1795 on his way to see Niagara Falls. His account says that the friend's room was, quote, exquisitely neat and resembles more the boudoir of a fine lady than the cell of a nun. It contained a looking glass, a clock, an armchair, a good bed, a warming pan, and a silver saucer. The room was also full of cheese, milk, butcher's meat, and game, which was a bad look, considering that New Jerusalem was just coming out of multiple consecutive years of rough harvests, and some of the followers had had to go hungry last winter. William Potter, the Rhode Island judge who'd once given up his house and slaves to follow the friend, now began inveighing against the friend. Back when James Parker had been a follower, he'd gotten himself elected as County Justice of the Peace, relying on the suggestion and the votes of the sisterhood. Now he still held that office, and it was a powerful cudgel to wield against the people he'd once seen as his allies. He didn't have enough evidence that anything had happened between the friend and that 14-year-old girl. I really think that was a myth. So, he and Potter began looking for some other crime to charge the friend with. Well, hadn't the friend claimed to be the second coming of Jesus? Parker decided to slap the friend with a blasphemy charge. Three bumbling attempts were made to arrest the friend. The first one ended in a police chase on horseback. The friend, a gifted rider, escaped. Next, an attempt was made to arrest the friend at the friend's mansion in New Jerusalem. A mob of the friend's supporters, mostly consisting of the sisterhood, blocked the constables from entering. Lastly, Parker summoned a posse of over 50 people, almost all of which, remarkably, were former followers of the friend. Finally, the friend was apprehended and dragged into court. Supporters and ex-supporters geared up for what was going to be a gripping trial. There seemed to be a fair amount of evidence supporting both sides. Dozens of witnesses recalled hearing that the friend explicitly self-identified with Jesus or explicitly refused to self-identify with Jesus. It didn't even necessarily divide along lines of who continued to support the friend. Some who had gotten disgruntled with the friend's leadership admitted that the friend never, to their knowledge, claimed to be Jesus, while one continuing supporter made the lonely argument that, yes, the friend did claim to be Jesus because that's precisely who the friend is. Then the case was dismissed on a technicality. The three judges overseeing the friend's prosecution couldn't agree on if blasphemy was even a crime in the state of New York. America was independent now. They had freedom of religion in the sense of you can follow whatever Christian sect you want. Did that also mean you have the right to claim you yourself are Jesus? That had never been legal in any Christian-majority country before, but two of the three judges argued that, yes, it should be. The third judge, James Parker, was forced to let the friend go, finding that regardless of what the friend had or hadn't claimed, the friend ultimately couldn't be charged with anything illegal. The friend's former friends didn't stop trying to land the friend in legal trouble. Now they went after the friend over the minutiae of the land sales they'd all been involved in when they moved to New Jerusalem. People were constantly leaving the friend's fellowship at this point, and when they left, the friend and the sisterhood would demand that they get the hell out of New Jerusalem. But they owned their houses, didn't they? Wasn't everything in New Jerusalem private property? The friend couldn't do that. That formed the basis of most of the friend's legal issues. In court, under duress, the friend admitted that Jemima Wilkinson and the public universal friend were the same person. Even though the friend ultimately won the main court case pursued against the friend by ex-followers, it took years, and fighting the land disputes bankrupted New Jerusalem. Even after winning, the few remaining followers were so sick of having to shovel through this bureaucracy they hated each other. The friend fell ill, retreated to the inner quarters of the New Jerusalem mansion, rarely ever preached, even to the dwindling flock who still lived there, and finally died on July 1st, 1819, just over 42 years after Jemima Wilkinson had had her fever. A small funeral was held, after which the Friends' last remaining followers camped out for days in the basement where the Friends' coffin had been placed, expecting the Friend to return from the dead. One by one, as the days passed, they went their separate ways. One former follower finally gave the Friend a formal burial in an unmarked, unknown grave, in keeping with Quaker practice at the time. Another wandered off into the woods of Maine and claimed to have prophetic dreams from the Friend, but had no success in re-establishing the Friend's cult. The Society of Universal Friends continued to exist all the way until 1874, but mostly as a charity, losing its remaining religious trappings just a few years after the Friend's death. To start a successful cult, you don't need a charismatic leader, or rather, you do, but that's not all you need. You need two charismatic leaders. You need the visionary and the successor. Ideally, the second one should be even more charismatic. To build a movement as powerful as, say, Mormonism, which began not too far away from where the public Universal Friend died just a few decades later, you need not just Joseph Smith, but also Brigham Young. You need George Fox and William Penn. You need L. Ron Hubbard and David Miscavige. You need Jesus and the Apostles. You need Eliezer Yudkowsky and Scott Alexander. You need the Great Peacemaker and Hiawatha. You need Wallace Fard Muhammad and Elijah Muhammad. You need Marx and Engels. That dynamic, the creator of it all, and their smartest, most gregarious, most devoted follower, is all you need to start a movement that lasts. Even after the successor figure is long gone, you only need one smooth transfer of power for the mandate of heaven to transubstantiate from you to your followers. Your beliefs can be as crazy as you want, but what decides whether a distinctive movement lives or dies is the charisma not of the leader, but of the leader's chosen successor. Otherwise, when death inevitably comes, everyone just stands around the grave of the leader, hoping against hope that they'll return from the dead. Nobody has the authority to say, our leader will be back eventually, or their body may be dead, but their words live on, so march on. William Potter could have taken up the public Universal Friend's legacy, since he purportedly reconciled with the Friend right before the Friend's death, but another issue that prevented the public Universal Friend's movement from outliving the Friend was that they really weren't cult-like enough. The other thing a successful cult needs is something weird that separates insiders and outsiders. You need Xenu. You need a fundamental belief so strange that only those who are truly committed devote themselves to it. The public Universal Friend being a genderless divine entity who possessed the body of the deceased Jemima Wilkinson fits the bill, but the whole rest of the Friend's theology was bog-standard Quakerism. If William Potter had taken the reins, the Society of Universal Friends would have just been a Quaker offshoot, different from the main stem only in having the word universal in its name, and the reason it was separate from the rest of the Quakers would be a strange historical footnote. Perhaps so many people left simply because it was easy to leave. If you hear about the public Universal Friend today, it's as a non-binary pioneer. Once again, the Friend may have been the first individual person referred to in English with they-them pronouns, or possibly a trans mask pioneer, because many of the Friend's followers consistently referred to the Friend as a he. We draw a line from the public Universal Friend directly to queer icons like Genesis P. Orridge, as if that's one consistent phenomenon, as if we, in 21st century blue America, have finally found the correct way to slice and dice the vast n-dimensional hypercube of how culture interacts with gender, as if every one of the rainbow of gender identities that has a pride flag now has always existed in every culture, as if there must have been as many public Universal Friends in the 1700s as there are they-thems watching this video now, and it's only because of oppression that we don't know about them. Certainly, some things are universal. Some people in every time and place will be uncomfortable with the expectations society has placed on their gender, but that manifests in as many different ways as there are ways to put expectations on someone's gender. I put non-binary in the title because that's how we all see the public Universal Friend now, but the word non-binary was coined in the 1990s. I mean that in the sense that I mean, say, Pet Sounds was the first emo album. It's a useful way to talk about it, but no, Pet Sounds is Pet Sounds. The public Universal Friend was the public Universal Friend. Some people may ask, since the friend was friendly with Native Americans, could the idea that you could be neither male nor female, to not just consider that thought, as I'm sure millions of people always have, but to really consider that that's something you could outwardly be and live as, have occurred to Jemima Wilkinson because she knew someone who was a two-spirit? No. Some tribes across America had a cultural concept of a third gender. Some tribes saw such people as spiritual leaders, but those tribes were mostly in the West. Others discriminated against gender nonconforming people. Others simply didn't have the concept in their culture. The catch-all term two-spirit was coined once again in 1990. The tribes of the Northeast probably didn't ever have a third gender, and while that's disputed, by the 18th century, I highly doubt a Quaker in Rhode Island could ever have met someone who didn't identify as strictly male or female. Two spirits are a modern thing. I'm not saying it's inauthentic to true Native American culture. What is true Native American culture? Sure as hell isn't my place to talk. Two spirits are a phenomenon authentic to 21st century Native American culture. But the idea that either pre-colonization Native Americans or the public universal friend had the same views on gender as your average Democratic donor circa 2020 is deeply misguided. To the extent that there's any precedent at all to a figure like the public universal friend, it's fundamentally rooted in Quaker egalitarianism. In a world of incredibly harsh gender roles, allowing women to preach was a step nearly as radical as abolishing gender altogether. If we are all children of God, why don't we just stop there, said the public universal friend. What more do we need? It reminds me a bit of Mogai, the mid-2010s Tumblr project to classify and invent as many obscure gender identities as possible. Let me pull up a random page on the Mogai wiki. Desgender, a xenogender or gastrogender in which one's gender is affected by desserts. Another random article, Fakaleti, a Tongan individual assigned male at birth with feminine gender expression. See, this gets my point across perfectly. Sleepy Joe, you ain't seen nothing yet. A decade later, this stuff is seen as cringe and deeply of its times, but it speaks to something important. Your gender identity is more than just, do you see yourself as a man, woman, or something else? It's also the why. What makes you feel like the gender you are? Because it's definitely, at least partially, the culture you're surrounded by. The public universal friend wasn't non-binary. That's a 21st century identity. The public universal friend was Quaker gender. Mm-hmm.